This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The record books, but widespread annual droughts, once a rare calamity, have become more frequent and are set to become the new normal. Until recently, many scientists spoke of climate change mainly as a threat, something in the future. But it is increasingly clear that we already live in an era of human-induced climate change, with a growing frequency of weather and climate extremes like heat waves, droughts, floods, and fires. This morning, we'll discuss the current severe drought conditions being experienced throughout many parts of North America with Christopher Williams, an expert on the magnitude and effects of this decade's extreme droughts. Christopher is assistant professor in the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Chris, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we're actually in a week of extreme weather, so I know that this is maybe the opposite of what you're focusing on with drought, but let's talk a little bit about these tornadoes that are happening in the Midwest right now. And do you have a hunch that this may be climate change induced?
Tornadoes are typical throughout much of the Midwest, and that's not something that I focus on in particular. And so I don't really care to comment in great detail other than say that, again, tornadoes are common enough and have happened many times in the past in this region. It's a place that's well known for its tornado activity. That said, there is some expectation that with stronger climate contrast from north to south across that region, we might see an intensification of some of the intensity of some of the tornadoes. And so there is some potential risk for that. But again, that's not really my area of expertise, so I'm hesitant to comment too knowledgeably about that.
Okay, well, we'll get back to the other side of weather now and to the droughts, which is your area of expertise. And last summer, there were a lot of rather stunning images of these cracked, parched fields and withered corn, and a lot of talk about how the drought of 2012 was one of the worst droughts on history. Now, how does it look for this year? Has there been any signs of it relenting, or are we heading into another year of extreme drought?
So there are some signs of improvement of what was still a rather dry winter across much of even the Midwest, but there were some spring rains that improved the picture for part of the what many of us think of across the country as the core crop-growing region of the Midwest. However, unfortunately, things still look rather dry, and there's a persisting drought current condition as well as forecast through much of the summer and growing seasons that are so important to our agricultural production. And so in your area of the country, as well as extending all the way to parts of Nebraska and Kansas, we could still expect to see a very dry summer with low agricultural yield.
Well, I was looking at some of the maps that are connected to articles that you've written on websites, and the drought, I mean, it seems like it's stretched. The maps were, I think, from 2012, and there's one that was early 2013. And it's a wide swath of the Midwest, the center of the state of the United States, and the Rocky Mountain West that is experiencing this drought, and then just a little bit of the southeast corner of Oregon. And it's actually been a rather bit of a disconnect for those of us on the West Coast. We keep hearing about this intense drought, but this year hasn't been quite as rainy, but the 2 years before that, Oregon and California and Washington experienced some of the rainiest springs and early summers that people my age can remember, which is, you know, a number of years. So how do we correlate, if we're living in an area that's not experiencing drought, to understand what is really going on for the bulk of the United States and actually probably for a lot of other parts of the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can imagine everybody in Oregon, at least those who've lived over the past 10 years, will remember some droughts of the recent past. So of course, it's something that we can all connect to and remember. One of the things that I've published on recently was the 2000-2004 drought, what we call the turn of the century drought, which affected much of the western United States, and including parts of Oregon that saw significant drought in some years. It's true also that the Pacific Northwest region, Oregon, Washington, maybe parts of Northern California and parts of Idaho, can often experience wet conditions when there are dry conditions across places further south or into the central Breadbelt and agricultural region of the country. And so it's not uncommon. In fact, it's characteristic of drought to be firing off in one place when it's relatively wet in another. One of the things that tends to bring drought to the southwest is a La Nina-like condition. And when you have a La Nina Pacific Ocean condition, you tend to have wetter conditions in your part of the country. In fact, there's a kind of a seesaw pattern between these two regions, which when you have wet conditions connected to that ocean sea surface temperature pattern, in the northwest, you tend to have drier conditions in the southwest. So it's not uncommon, I think, for you to hear reports of dry conditions elsewhere in the country, but maybe not experience them locally.
Well, I mean, I'm familiar with these cycles of droughts. And I mean, I've been on the West Coast for over 40 years now, and I remember when I first moved to California in the beginning of the 70s, it was in the very beginning of a seven-year drought. And in fact, it gave me a very unrealistic, in a way, or unbalanced idea of what weather was like in California for the brief time I lived there, and discovered later that, in fact, it could be a lot wetter in Northern California than I had experienced. Again, in 2002, I was spending a lot of time in the Southwest, and I one time was flying into Las Vegas and flew over Lake Mead, and people were commenting on how low Lake Mead was. And I looked down, I'd never seen it before, but you could see the bathtub marks and that it was dramatically low. At the same time, I was also watching Lake Shasta, which I drove by a lot in my trips down to California, and I was kind of watching it almost visibly drop over a period of 2 years. So those droughts, I think even back in 2002, 2004, when there was a lot more talk about climate change being an issue, we still sort of saw that as, oh, we have our normal cycles of drought and wet. But I'm wondering if it's changed now, and if the current drought that we're experiencing is maybe on a different level than what we have seen in the past 100 years.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Barbara. I'm glad you raised that. I think there are a few things that make it difficult for us to think about drought as being possibly something different today than what it's been in the past. Of course, drought is a common feature of the climate system, and we see, just as you said, natural variability. Years that are wet, years that are dry, and sometimes those dry conditions stack up a whole bunch in a row, and it produces a really pronounced and prolonged drought. And in fact, centuries ago, there were these mega droughts, even a millennia ago, a thousand years ago. And this is something that exists in the absence of current anthropogenic or human-caused climate change, which is something that we often connect to. And you started with the introduction to this segment was a reading from one of the pieces that we wrote in the New York Times, in which we make that connection. We actually make a fairly clear connection between droughts of today and what droughts of the future might be like. The reason why we make that connection is because we see that climate forecasts tell us very clearly that the southwestern United States, as well as even all the way up to Oregon, is a part of the country that is predicted to experience pronounced drying trend and deeper droughts. So this means in the future, if we have continued dependence on fossil fuels and release of greenhouse gases. So what does that mean? It really means two things. It means that this part of the country is expected to become drier than it is today on average. And also, when you have a drought, when that natural variability produces a departure or a reduction in what would be the season typical rainfall, it's going to be that much worse. So you put essentially natural variability on top of a long-term trend towards drying. And when you put those two things together, for much of the Southwest, as even much of the American West, the picture doesn't look so rosy.
Well, let's talk a bit about some of the dynamics that create drier and drier conditions that have to do with warming at the same time. Like what happens to the soil and why does the soil dry out?
Yeah, well, there are a few things that are expected. Let's talk specifically about Oregon. One of the things that you experience in your local climate is a seasonal variability in rainfall. You get a lot of your rainfall from October to May, and then you've got a relatively dry period through, at least for much of the state, throughout the summer months, the Northern Hemisphere summer months. And so that timing of precipitation is really pronounced and important. It influences, essentially you see a decrease in the precipitation right when the evaporation and the irrigation demand picks up. So if we were to see a decrease in wintertime precipitation, or particularly summertime precipitation, you might expect to see hotter, drier soil conditions, drier soils, and even the average condition would be a drier one. And that is something that we see forecast in the climate models. So what would that be like? Well, you would have to irrigate more. You might actually experience a transition from snowmelt driven hydrographs or river flows towards a more precipitation-dominated one. And that's also of concern because precipitation when it arrives as rainfall tends to be flashier, more flood-like, and so it runs off more readily, whereas snowpack tends to restore the precipitation towards the summer season, allowing it to gradually infiltrate, recharge groundwater, and also gradually be released to rivers.
Well, the other big thing is, I mean, we do have a fair number of dams and water storage here, but probably the predominant amount of our water is stored in the glaciers and in the ice fields and the mountains throughout the Northwest. And the idea that we would lose that kind of water bank, which is probably pretty unusual in the rest of the United States to have this much water stored up and locked up in ice. So that also gives us a concern. I mean, if the the snow on the mountains is going to be melting sooner, what does that mean in terms of water storage, or how do we replace that kind of storage with some other kind of storage, or is it even possible to do that?
It could certainly be a challenge. One of the things I was just reading was the Oregon Integrated Water Resources Strategy that was published back in August of last year. And one of the things that they noted was that a large portion of the state's population is actually dependent pretty heavily on snowmelt. About 50%, they estimate, of Oregon's water users are classified as being snowpack dependent. That means that they rely on snowmelt and recharge of the water sources coming in late spring and early summer. The loss of that snowpack, I don't know exactly what it would mean, especially as you correctly point out how there's some degree of increased, there's a certain capacity of water storage in reservoirs, but it certainly could mean that that soils would be drier still in summer, and that the timing of when water is released and available would shift. That's also of concern, of course, for reservoir management, because if you know they have a certain capacity and they need to produce hydroelectric power continuously, you've got a huge production of hydroelectric power. Oregon is the nation's second largest hydroelectric producer, behind only Washington, and so. Hydroelectric power is a really important source of electricity, and this could be impacted by whether precipitation arrives as snow versus rain.
Well, we're talking this morning about the intensifying droughts and whether we are headed for another mega drought or even a dust bowl. And my guest is Christopher Williams, who is assistant professor in the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. I was talking to a friend who grew up in the panhandle of Texas recently, and she'd just come back from visiting her family near Amarillo, Texas. She's describing these dust storms that I had not heard about, but she said there were 50, 60-mile-an-hour winds blowing all the time and lots of dust. Is that something that you're familiar with, and are we beginning to see the signs of another dust bowl emerging?
I think it would be too early to say that we're seeing the signs of another dust bowl emerging. There have been some pretty significant changes in the way we use the land since the historic dust bowl of the 30s that were strongly induced by, or at least the intensity of the dust bowl period was strongly impacted by how we were using the land then. We were plowing our fields pretty regularly. We were tilling and turning over the soil. It made a lot of soil particles available for the winds to pick them up and move them and bury other parts of the landscape. And so we're not really practicing agriculture in the same way that we were at that time. And so I think we're a little bit less prone to creating the Dust Bowl-type conditions that were experienced then. Now, it could well be that, in fact, still there are sufficient natural conditions, the wind speeds and so forth, to be able to create that kind of bombardment of particles. I don't mean to suggest that it can't happen today, but I think that one of the things that was really important in producing the dust bowl of the 30s and 40s was the way we were using the land. And so it seems unlikely that we're, at least human activity is going to trigger that kind of future.
Well, my understanding actually according to Timothy Egan's rather major book on this issue, that what triggered the dust bowl was plowing up prairie. And that the original buffalo grass that grew on the prairie natively held the soil in place. And when they started plowing it, there was nothing to really hold the topsoil in place. And that's why it all started blowing to blowing to Washington, D.C. and all over the place. But the other thing, that one of the ways that they tried to solve the issue with the Civilian Conservation Corps during the Roosevelt administration was to get farmers to stop tilling from fence row to fence row, basically, to start planting windbreaks of trees, and that they did that throughout the late 30s and 40s. And actually, that was a big improvement. But then under Earl Butz and the Nixon administration, they started cutting down all the trees again and starting again to plow from and plant from fence row to fence row. So I've read some concerns that the current tilling practices in the Midwest and in the just east of the Rocky Mountains is in fact could create similar Dust Bowl conditions again. So I'm wondering if you're familiar at all with any of that.
Not in the detail that you are. That's a great overview of the topic.
So it gets me into another issue that you have written about, which is some of our agricultural practices and what we choose to grow on the land, and how it may be might be averting its eyes from some of the serious concerns that you're raising about climate change, warming, and more intensified droughts, and particularly the use of land to grow corn for ethanol as opposed to growing crops that people could actually eat.
That's a very interesting topic. It's not actually something that I've written about. Could well be that there's another Chris Williams out there who's done so, but crop selection and the way we manage the land is certainly an important factor in controlling or influencing our vulnerability to droughts and the way in which we need to irrigate, as well as the sort of follow-on effects of how the land surface feeds back to the atmosphere, affecting possible future precipitation downwind.
So what are we, as you're looking at all the signs that are pointing towards some more intensified droughts that could be connected to climate change, what are you seeing as things that we need to be concerned about that we don't seem to be paying close enough attention to?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think I'll try to step back and paint what I think is a big picture view of what's happening. We see that there's a long-term drying trend that we can expect in the future with continued dependence on fossil fuels for the most part. The greenhouse gases that are accumulating in the atmosphere are expected to cause a drying trend into the future for much of the western United States. And so the big picture about what's causing that is, well, the things that that allow greenhouse gases to accumulate in the atmosphere, and that's really our dependence on fossil fuels. It's also our deforestation, and right now in the big picture for the global carbon cycle, we emit something on the order of about 10 petagrams of carbon per year globally across from carbon dioxide, from combustion of fossil fuels, and from cement production, and a variety of other sources, also with methane and nitrous oxide and other greenhouse gases in the mix. And that's really that kind of activity that's been active for the past 100 years, and especially so in the past 50 years and still rising, is expected to cause a significant drying of the West unless we do something soon. And so I think that's really the big picture regarding what's pushing the system, the climate throughout the American West, but also globally in many of the dry regions, pushing them to become drier. So if that's the push, there's another side of the story, which is maybe we can respond by mitigation or adaptation. So we could attempt to mitigate by reducing our emissions and also by reducing our dependence on limited water resources. There are a bunch of things that we can do to make our communities more drought ready. And to impose there's a whole list. There's a great source, I think, that if your readers would want to learn more about it, I'd point them to the Drought Readiness Communities Report. It's a guide to community drought preparedness developed by the National Drought Mitigation Center and a variety of state water and climatological surveys. And they give us some guides as to what might be done to reduce risks and avoid some of the losses, to conserve water and so forth. So there are a whole bunch of actions that we might be able to put into place to avoid some of the likely consequences of our continued use of fossil fuels. And so for me, the big picture is really about maybe there's something we can do about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and also there's a variety of things we need to do to start preparing for what could well be a drier future.
Well, what are some of the things that we could do to mitigate? The obvious one is we could drive less, we could become much less reliant on fossil fuel. We could have an energy policy in the United States that really encouraged renewable energy and non-fossil fuel energy generation. But what else besides those do you see as constructive mitigative steps?
Well, those are all really good ones, and they're really, I think, the biggest ones that are worth talking about. There's another one that you didn't mention, which is to protect forests and existing carbon stocks in the land. Deforestation is another major player, a sizable wedge in the puzzle of the circle of carbon emissions and greenhouse gases accumulating in the atmosphere. And everything we can do within reason to protect forests and other carbon stores in the landscape would be worth doing. So that's another big one that we should be thinking about.
And I also, I think, recall, if I'm thinking of the right article, that you also talk about an issue with drought is that it makes crops less carbon, not as good carbon sinks because of what happens when crops are stressed by too much drought. So could you describe a little bit about what that whole dynamic is and why even like a field of corn or soybeans or wheat isn't going to hold the same amount of carbon under drought conditions as it would under wetter conditions?
Right. So my way into this topic was really to think about what the carbon consequences of drought have been. And when I talk about carbon consequences, I'm thinking about how in normal conditions, in normal climate conditions, North America absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through its natural ecosystem carbon sinks. And this serves as an offset to the emissions that we provide in terms of greenhouse gases, the CO2 emissions and so forth. And so what our study of this turn of the century drought examined that you were referring to was about how that typical carbon uptake for the region was severely impaired by a large-scale and persistent drought that struck the western North American region for that five-year period, 2000-2004. Not every place, every year, but certainly over the large region for that five-year period. And so what we found was, using observation networks of a variety of kinds, we found that there was a 50% reduction in the amount of carbon that was taken up by ecosystems, including croplands, but also forests and rangelands and woodlands, about a 50% reduction in the carbon that they take up in the typical year. So that amounts to about, that over 5 years, that amounts to about 800 teragrams of carbon, which is an awful lot of carbon. It's nearly the equivalent of about a year's worth of deforestation globally. Or about 10% of annual CO2 emissions from the burning of fossil fuels. So it can really add up. And this is just one region that fired off, if you will, with a significant drought. And we're seeing the same kind of impacts from droughts across the world. In Europe, there have been droughts of this magnitude, and in Africa, in Australia, in many places. And a lot of the general mantra about what can be expected in the future is that continued fossil fuel dependence will lead to drier places getting drier. And so at least in those regions, we can expect to see less carbon dioxide molecules getting stored by the process of photosynthesis and getting stored in carbon sinks in ecosystems.
And
it's
then,
really, it's really the story about trees putting on annular rings of carbon and storing some of that carbon in their tissue.
Well, I'm thinking, too, that and the other side of that is that we have a great deal of carbon release to the atmosphere when there's increased forest fires and range fires that also are part of the drought. And I'm just thinking back when I was trying to remember, well, what was going on here in Oregon between 2000 and 2004? Oh, yes, we had like 2 years of the most massive forest fires we'd had since the 1940s. And the largest, at that point, the largest wildfire in Oregon ever, the Biscuit Fire. Then, interestingly, last year we had an even larger fire. It was a grassland fire. And it was in the one corner of Oregon that is experiencing the drought in southeast Oregon, far southeast Oregon. So how does that give us a sense of the future? I mean, when we look at some of the massive fires that have happened in the last few years during the drought periods, what clues does that give us as to what we could expect if we don't do something to mitigate climate change?
I think you've nailed it. I mean, just to add to the memory and the statistics, as we think at the country scale, 8 out of the last 10 years were in the top 10 for total area burned by fires. Over the past, since 1960, over the past 50 or so years. So in 2006 alone, there were nearly 10 million acres that were burned. Last year, it was 9.3 million acres. 2008 was another really big year. These statistics are coming from the National Interagency Fire Center. You can find them on their website. And it's this really important inventory, repository of information about the area burned annually across the U.S. as well as regionally within that. And much of this has happened in the West. Fire has taken over. It's really taken off. In the 80s, we saw about half as large an area burned as we're seeing today. And some of this is due to the drier conditions that we're seeing. The 2000-2004 period were exactly as you said, very large fire years, most of them at least. 2003, 2004, 2005, these were all relatively large fire years. Sorry, not 2003, but many of the others.
Actually, we had a big fire in 2003 in the Three Sisters area. And then also 2002 was the biggest fire in Oregon.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm aware of the Biscuit Fire, and there have been lots of record fires in recent years. And this is a variety. There are a few major factors that contribute to this: climate change, or at least climate drier conditions of the recent past, of the last decade, have contributed significantly to a larger area burned. And in fact, there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that climate or fire weather is really the major control on how much and how severely fires burn across the West. Now, there's also been, as you know, historical practice of suppressing fires, and that can allow fuels to build up. And an element of the story is related to that. I don't know exactly how much of the story is related to each of these two things, but what's clear is that when you have drier conditions, we have larger area burned. And so as we pitch that forward to think about what might take place over the next 20 or 50 or 100 years, if we see a transition towards a drier future, we could certainly expect to see more damaging wildfires.
Well, I'm talking this morning with Christopher Williams, who is assistant professor in the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University, a school that's very well known for its geography department, as I recall, since I spent a lot of my youth hanging out at Clark, actually, when I was growing up. And I'm curious about the direction the geography department is going now at Clark. Is there a lot of emphasis now on looking at the impacts of climate change and sort of plotting it out geographically?
There certainly is. And many of us are geographers by training. I'm actually less of a geographer by training, though very happy to find myself in a comfortable home here at Clark Geography. But some of the relatively recent recruits to our department have been as much from the geosciences as from geography. And so we're studying a whole range of things related to climate change. Some of us are studying permafrost and its vulnerability to release through thawing, and its export and delivery through waterways, for example, in Siberia and in Alaska, northern Canada, to adjacent oceans, and how that creates a nutrient pulse and also a release of carbon potentially to the atmosphere, certainly to the oceans. There are others who are studying, in fact, just last year, one of my close colleagues just down the hall, last week, published a paper in one of our field's most respected journals, Science, and he was talking about the important contributions of glaciers to total sea level rise, and how while they're a relatively small fraction of all the ice and snow, but particularly ice, stored up on the planet, they actually contribute, because they're being lost so quickly, they contribute a really large fraction, maybe as much as a third of all the sea level rise due to water inputs. And so we're studying those elements, but some other close colleagues, Dominic Kulikowski and John Rogan, are experts on fire from remote sensing and tree ring perspectives, as well as we're all studying how the bark beetle epidemics that have been taking off across the western U.S. and into British Columbia and parts of western Canada are also causing a positive feedback. And in fact, there's a climate change connection to that story as well. So we're doing a whole range of things related to climate change. And I think while I wasn't here, I've only been here for about 5 years, and so I can't say what the long-term plan was when I was hired, but I have seen, even since I arrived, recruitment of folks thinking about climate change, not just from a mapping perspective, but also from a mechanistic perspective.
I'm kind of curious, since you're located in the Northeast, why so much of your study seems to be focused on the West.
Yeah, so I've actually lived in part of the West a few times in my life. I studied at Colorado State University. I got a master's in hydrology or watershed science from CSU. I've also, as an aside, I studied river regulation and how that affects riparian cottonwood trees and forests downstream. And I also lived there again during a postdoctoral period. So I'm familiar with Fort Collins and the Front Range and some of the challenges of water resources throughout that part of the country, and have just remained interested in the West. The way I got involved in this particular project was I was really I was working at NASA at the time, and I was asked to, I was hired to try to assess the current drivers and the magnitude of the carbon balance of forests across the United States. We know that forest carbon sinks are important, as I mentioned before. That is, they take carbon dioxide up out of the atmosphere. Forests are also regrowing from a historical pattern of land clearing. And so we see maturing forests, for example, in the Northeast. There's current harvest practices that are taking place across the country, certainly in your part of the world, as well as in the Southeast, South Central states. It's pretty vigorous. And then we have...
You're talking about clear cutting, basically, right?
Especially clear cutting, but also rotation planting and so forth. It comes by many names, but harvesting in general. Some of it's partial clearing. A lot of it these days is partial and selective logging. So, and then also there are a whole bunch of new drivers of carbon uptake that makes it faster today than it used to be. Forests tend to be, there's evidence suggesting forests are growing faster today than they used to because of fertilization by CO2, by carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and fertilization by nitrogen deposition, some of it from industrial sources. And so there are a whole bunch of changing patterns that are driving forests to grow differently and store carbon in different amounts. And indeed, we also see fire and bark beetles and drought causing carbon emissions in forests, as well as rangelands and agricultural lands. So really, that was, again, my way into this general topic, to study. I study drought extremes and their impact on the carbon balance. I'm also studying the forest carbon balance at the country scale and trying to understand its drivers. So that's because the drivers are really pronounced, these fire, drought, and bark beetle impacts are so pronounced across the West, it was an obvious area for me to focus on.
Now, I'm wondering how much people in the Northeast who aren't necessarily quite as closely connected to agriculture as people in the Midwest and the West are, how much they're aware of what's going on with the increasing drought conditions in the places where their food is being grown.
Yeah, you know, that's something I haven't performed any scientific analysis on, but I'm very curious about more than anything, just as you are. You know, I think that if I look, for example, now at the current maps of the seasonal drought outlook, I see that about a half to almost two-thirds of the country is in some state of significant drought. And yet I think it's not as much in the headlines as it was as it has been in other years. One of the things that made last year's drought so well reported was that it really hit a major agricultural center. And so we started to see the evidence even more clearly. I guess what I'm saying is that when drought, exactly as to your point, when drought hits you in a certain way, I think the awareness is far broader. Part of what we saw also last year was it was pretty hot in much of even the East. And when we see droughts in the East, they're even more well-reported. And so I think you're right about it being a certain distance or degree of closeness to home and how important that is in the way we understand drought.
Well, I recall a few years ago that drought was so bad in Georgia that it was actually affecting water usage in Atlanta. And another place that's like pretty far, I mean, the urban sprawl around Atlanta like really separates it quite a bit from where their food is grown there. But it seems that it's an important thing for those of us who live in cities to start to appreciate that droughts can have a pretty major effect in our lives.
It can. And then we can also ask ourselves, you know, how many of us who are used to a certain supply, how many of us saw food shortages? Probably not many last year because of the significant droughts, despite the impact on agricultural production. And so I think in perhaps even other parts of the world, that kind of drought impact might be felt even more strongly. For example, in parts of, say, East Africa, where famine can really take off because of a drought.
Well, what is your thought about our dealing with the fact that we may be heading into long-term drought? Do you think that that's a possibility and that we are prepared for the consequences of that?
Well, I just want to, before I get into that, mention that I'm not, the forecasts do not clearly state that there will be significant drought through the major agricultural growing regions of the United States, where by major I mean the Midwest. Certainly we can expect that over the next 100 years, that drying trend, according to climate models, would be strong in the Southwest as well as parts of the southern Pacific Northwest and Rocky Mountain North states. And so we could expect to see significant effects in those agricultural regions as well as just for all the other livelihoods that take place there. So I guess your question was also, are we prepared enough? Are we perhaps not really aware of how significant this could be? It's a good question. I think there have been major efforts, in part in response to the major drought of last year, but even from previous droughts and the dry conditions throughout the Colorado River Basin, for example, over the early part of the 21st century, that have led states to start to plan very carefully and municipalities to start to plan very carefully. And I think that's a really important and positive trend. As an example, Oregon, as I mentioned earlier, now has its first integrated water resources strategy, and that's to be applauded and commended. From reading that report, or at least the executive summary of it, it suggests to me that you've got all the right capacity and individuals at the table thinking about this in a really important way, so that you are likely to be well prepared. You're starting to take the steps towards long-range planning at multiple levels, federal, state, as well as local. And I think we, of course, have significant work to do, and that's clearly what's needed, is longer-range water planning and to start to implement water conservation practices to be prepared for the possibility of significant drought in the future.
Well, I'm remembering about 11 years ago, I was at a conference, a workshop fellowship at USC, and heard some water experts from University of Washington in Seattle talking about a lot of things that you're talking about now, and basically how we were going to be losing our glaciers and our snowpack, and we're going to have to rely on larger reservoirs to store water. And it was just too much to deal with. And I just was sitting there thinking, oh, can't be true. And we still have a lot of water in the west side of Oregon. And I'm thinking how hard it is for people, just ordinary citizens, to start wrapping their head around how things may be changing. And even in parts of the United States, like the Northwest, that have been traditionally very wet, that we have to rethink the way we relate to water. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on how do we get people to really embrace that this is a reality we have to deal with?
Well, I think you say that the Northwest is wet, and that is true, but if you drive to the east of your state, you'll see that it's actually not so wet.
Yeah, I'm talking about the wet side of the Northwest. There's a big divide in Oregon. People east of the Cascades certainly understand water shortages, but I think people in the Willamette Valley and up through the Puget Sound, it's hard to imagine running out of water in these areas.
It is hard to relate to, and perhaps maybe those places are relatively safe, and I haven't done any formal analysis to know whether or not that's true. In that report that I mentioned before, I read you have about 100 million acre feet of water that fills Oregon lakes, streams, and recharges groundwater aquifers every year. And meanwhile, you rely on withdrawals of only about 9 million acre feet of water with diversions out of stream. So that sounds like a pretty good margin, and a slight shift in that margin might be okay. If you were to have a smaller supply, maybe at least some parts of the state and in the Northwest would be still just fine. But then when you think about the regions that are important for producing a lot of the crops and how heavily dependent they are on irrigation and what infrastructures are available for that irrigation, maybe you realize the picture isn't quite as good. I saw that crops are about 85% of all this water diversion is for agricultural water use, and it produces about 77% of the total value of harvested crops, which is valued at nearly $3.4 or more billion dollars. So a small shift in that margin could speak loudly economically as well as in terms of livelihoods. And so careful planning of the water distribution systems and assessment and analysis of who gets water when there are shortages, I think all of that is pretty important.
Well, these are things we'll have to continue to talk about. But I want to thank you very much for joining us, Christopher.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And we've been talking this morning with Christopher Williams, who's assistant professor in the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. And actually what you need to do is go to the homepage, kboo.fm, and in the upper right-hand corner, you can do a search for Locus Focus and today's date, and the show will pop up. Next week, my guest is David Moskowitz, who's author of Wolves in the Land of Salmon. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Michael McDade. We're going to go out with some music by Tom Waits. Thanks for listening.
All right. the rain that they predicted. It's the forecast every time. The roses die because you picked it. I'm out here.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help sponsor the Triangle production version of Ave Maria, a musical about the 20th century's most famous Greeks, Aristotle Onassis and Maria Callas, starring Bruce Blanchard and Amy Jo Holliday. The musical will take place at The Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Ave Maria runs from May 2nd to May 26th. More information and tickets may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, T. Colin Campbell, is the co-author of The China Study, one of America's best-selling books about nutrition, a study the New York Times described as the Grand Prix of epidemiology. Campbell also was featured prominently in the 2011 documentary Forks Over Knives, and he is the Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University. He's here today on Health Watch to talk about his new book entitled Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition. And if you have questions for T. Colin Campbell today, you can reach us here at the studio at 503-231-8187. Welcome to Health Watch.
Thank you.
So, tell us, Dr. Campbell, what inspired you to write Whole?
Well, in a way, it comes from my first book, The China Study, which, in fact, is a chronology of sorts of my career in research, which goes back to the 1950s. I've been in this business more than a half century. And what I started out in the beginning with my work was my presumption that the good old American diet was the best there is, meat, milk, and eggs, if you will, plenty of protein. That was the idea. And so then when I got involved in doing my doctoral research at Cornell University, it also was designed to promote the consumption of essentially high-quality protein, which meant animal-based protein. But when I got involved in doing my research, and as was really all of it was funded by the National Institutes of Health, that's the taxpayer money, through the years, and doing studies both in the laboratory as well as in people studies, if you will, what I learned was something very, very different. In fact, when protein is fed in excess of the amount that is needed, it has the ability to turn on cancer and stimulate the formation of heart disease and many other things. And so then the question becomes, well, how much do we really need of this protein? What is an excess? Well, for a long time, ever since 1943, science has established, multiple times, that 10% of total calories is enough. Actually, we need less than that, but 10% is enough. And what we actually have been doing, for the most part, is consuming levels of protein that average around 70% higher than what is recommended, or at least 100% higher than what we actually need. And what that means, in turn, is the protein we're consuming is basically coming from animal foods. That's the level, in fact, that we find basically can turn on cancer experimentally. It can develop heart disease. We've known some of this for a long, long time. It's just been kind of hidden in the on the dust shelves in scientific libraries.
And when you talk... Sorry, go ahead, Dr. Campbell.
So as we sort of got caught up in this as a whole society, more and more protein, what that also meant, as we were consuming, you know, basically a lot of animal foods to get that protein, what we also learned was that the other nutrients, so-called nutrients, that come along with the animal-based foods or that are basically diminished by not consuming enough plant-based foods, what we also learned that all those other nutrients play in this same game. By increasing protein, for example, animal foods, we decrease the consumption of the antioxidants that are present in plant-based foods. We decrease the complex carbohydrates. We change the level of fat. So everything is going wrong, and it's just going to hell in a handbasket, basically. And so my research, and we probed this question in great depth in the laboratory, working inside of cells, if you will, inside of bodies, obviously, and thinking of it in that context, in a broad context. And what we also learned was that 10% level that has been long recommended and accepted as plenty enough protein, one can get that protein from a whole food plant-based diet. That's simple. A lot of people didn't even know that protein was in plants all that much, at least for a long time. And that protein is plenty. And it turns out that level of protein is not just the protein. I have to emphasize that, not just the protein, but it's actually the combination of all the things that come along because of our reverence for that protein. That's really what the question is. And so now, so I wrote the book in the China study, got to the end of it and said, here's the data. I don't like to preach and proselytize. I just wanted to present the information that we learned, you know, from the taxpayer money and go back to the